This is an ABC podcast.
20 years ago in August 2001, the cargo ship the Tampa was sailing from Fremantle to Singapore when a rescue call came through. There was a boat adrift and in distress. The Tampa's Norwegian captain, Arne Rinnan, radioed that he would immediately head his ship towards the emergency. And as he got closer, he saw an old wooden fishing boat listing in the waves, with people crowding on deck. A ladder was lowered down the side of the Tampa, and one by one, the people on that sinking boat climbed up the Tampa's massive red hull, looking for safety and refuge in Australia. One of those people climbing the ladder was 7-year-old Abbas Nazari. Abbas is now all grown up. He's a Fulbright scholar with a Master's in Security Studies from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And he's written a book called After the Tampa, From Afghanistan to New Zealand. Hi, Abbas.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Very well. I want you to tell me about the valley where you were born. What did it look like?
You know, for many folks, the imagery they have of Afghanistan is one of hot deserts and plains. But where I grew up was this lush, fertile valley high up in the central highlands of Afghanistan with beautiful snow-capped mountains and, you know, alpine streams coming down. It's an incredibly tranquil place to be born into. You know, I am fortunate enough to call the South Island of New Zealand home. And on most weekends when me and my friends are out there tramping in the bush, that's exactly what it looks like, especially in winter.
You say, as you say, there was a creek running through your village. Why would you go down there at night sometimes with your dad?
You know, that little creek was the lifeblood of our village. It provided all of the water to feed the animals, to tend to the land. And everyone had their water rights. There was no, obviously, formal irrigation system. So you'd be given a certain time of the day or the night to go in and move some of the dirt around to ensure that your fields were watered or someone else's wasn't overwatered. And I remember many times Dad and I, our clock might strike at 3 o'clock in the morning and would go out there to change the water.
What was your favourite season in the valley?
Oh, man, my favourite season has to be winter. You know, it was, you get four very distinct seasons over there. And winter would wake up, and the entire valley would be blanketed in snow, almost as if someone had spilt a bucket of white paint across the entire valley. And so it was incredibly harsh, incredibly cold, but, just a different level of beauty as well.
And how many kids in your family, Abbas?
At the time it was, mum and dad and five kids at the time, right? And that was home. That was home for us. Our family had been living there in the village of Sumjoy in the Central Highlands for multiple generations, dating back to my great-great-grandparents.
What kind of games do you remember playing with your big brothers and sister?
Oh, man. Games growing up as a little kid in Afghanistan are very different. We didn't have PS2s and we didn't have Xboxes, that's for sure. You know, it was a different world. I was particularly good at slingshot. A slingshot, you know, was kind of a weapon, a toy, whatever you want to call it. You know, with a really good at target practice in that regard. And then my brothers were really good at the long form version of the slingshot, which is this thing known as a palho, which is what the shepherds used to use to herd their animals from the other side of the valley. It's like a whip that makes a giant cracking sound. I could never master it.
As the youngest, what did you used to think watching your big sister and your brothers head off to school?
I always felt left out. You know, I was the youngest at the time, and you know, seeing these guys get up in the morning and get ready for school and have something to do, I always felt like, hey, why can't I be part of that? You know, I was probably a 3-4-year-old, and to the point where I pleaded and begged with my mum and dad to allow me to tag along with my brothers one day, even though I was probably 2 years below the official enrollment age. Yes, I enrolled at school before I was allowed to, and I think that was a sign of things to come.
What did the teacher make of this young, keen student turning up?
You know, on my very first day, unofficial day, you know, of school, they the teacher going, it's very rote learning, very basic. And the teacher was reading a particular passage which he got wrong. And I, being this snotty little brat, immediately corrected him in front of the other pupils. And that's the unwritten rule, that you never do that, never bring the teacher into disrepute. And I was expecting a big, you know, big hiding. But what I got instead was a teacher that said, actually, you know what, this new student of ours is right. And, you know, he stood corrected. And I think that paved the way for me to, you know, to come in for more lessons.
It sounds like a happy place to be a little kid, Abbas, even though there wasn't much money. It sounds like a pretty lovely place.
Yes, it was. I mean, you know, you don't want to paper over the fact that we lived with incredible challenges, living against the elements and living very much subsistence lifestyle. But it was where it lacked material wealth, there was prosperity in other measures. You know, there was an incredible sense of community, of people looking out for one another, of everyone having a role in the system. And so it was harsh, but there was richness there too.
As you were growing up, the Taliban were gaining ground in Afghanistan, and your family are Hazara. How did the Taliban see you?
You know, the Taliban essentially took over Afghanistan, and, you know, their one mission was to make Islam great again. And by doing so, they had a very, very decided and defined image of what they wanted Afghanistan to look like once they took over. And sadly, what that meant for ethnic and religious minorities, such as my people, the Hazara, that meant that there was no place for us. We had long been maligned and cast aside by successive powers throughout Afghan history, often brutally so. But when the Taliban took over, there was a program of forced displacement where folks like myself, my family, who had lived on these lands for generations, were kicked off and in the very worst instances, killed and massacred. So when they came in 1994 and eventually took over the country by 1996, it became very, very apparent that our lives would be immeasurably changed for the worse. And that's kind of the journey that's set the motion for our journey of why we had to leave.
What did you start noticing around the village?
One of the first things that you notice that things aren't right is, keep in mind, this is the view of a small child. Now, you start to see that there are less kids at school, that your classmates are starting to dwindle in number. Then you start to see that some of the houses in your village are starting to be boarded up and families just go missing overnight, and you find out that they left in the middle of the night. And then you start to see food shortages and the shops are closed and everything is just no longer normal. And beyond that, beyond the physical sense, that you could sense that there was a tension in the air, that people didn't feel safe, that people weren't happy with the way things were going. And that's, again, giving you the perspective of a little child. Beyond that, then you hear concrete news from my dad, who was a truck driver, that, you know, certain villages are ablaze or entire families have been wiped out. The Taliban have taken villages close to ours. And then that's when you start to form a bigger picture of the reality.
Do you remember, Abbas, your parents telling you that your family too would be leaving?
Yes. Mum and Dad had obviously been having hushed conversations for a while, to the point where one day Dad just firmly and decisively said, look, we are leaving, that we have to leave. Obviously, the wheels had been in motion for some time. You know, on his usual truck delivery routes, he had gone and organized paperwork and made phone calls and semi-planned an informal itinerary for us to get out of our village. And then he dropped the news onto us and he said, look, tomorrow's your last day of school. Say goodbye to your friends and your teachers. And that's it, because a truck will come by and pick us up. And that begins our journey out of our village that we'd known. That was the day. That was the start of it.
After boarding that lorry at your family village, your family made its way to the border crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan. What were things like at the border?
That was an incredibly chaotic scene. I remember it vividly, and I remember, just the herd of people in cars or camels or donkeys or people on foot with all their life belongings, you know, over their shoulder, trying to get past. Some of whom looked like they had documentation, and others who were just trying to make a pass at it. And so we're at this border crossing. We're in this taxi with obviously a hired driver that knows how to work the system. And the car ahead of us, they must not have had a document or something was missing, because before that driver could protest, the Taliban gunman just, you know, lifted up the butt of his rifle and brought it down on him, instantly knocking him out. And he went for a couple more goes. And we had no idea what was going on, but we were next. And so now we're thinking, is that what's going to happen to my dad? Is that what's going to happen to our driver? And the gunman, the militant, if he hadn't been stopped by his commander, he would obviously have killed the man ahead of us. But it just instantly, I remember that feeling of fear, as if you've just been frozen. So we're up next. And this time the commander who'd stopped his soldier comes up to us and, you know, pulls us aside and takes us into this little shed. And we can see through the cars, you know, that dad is there with the driver, handing over documentation and cash and jewelry and anything that he had, just to kind of make the passage easier. You know, dad parted way with his wedding ring and his watch and emptied his pockets, and that seemed to satisfy him, and immediately got back in the car and we drove on, and Afghanistan just sort of disappeared behind us in the rearview mirror in this cloud of dust. And that was, you know, our goodbye to the country that we were born in.
You made it safely to Quetta in Pakistan, and that's where you encountered your first banana. How did you like it?
You know, even though we're only in the neighboring country, we might as well have been on another world, you know, having grown up and lived in the lifestyle of a village in the central highlands of Afghanistan to now in almost tropical Pakistan, where you have exotic fruits such as mango and banana. You have no idea what you're doing. And so my first banana experience was served to us on the plate in this little place that we were staying. Had no idea what to do. And so my brother and I just grab one, look at it, examine it, and we just take a bite, you know, with skin on. We just jumped into it, skin on, trying to chew this thing. It's all mushy on the inside. And we thought, okay, this is probably the worst fruit we've tasted. And our host is laughing. He's in hysterics. And he's like, okay, you guys have a long way to go here.
How did your parents get the idea to try and make their way to Australia from Pakistan?
You know, that's the part of the story that a lot of people can't wrap their heads around. You know, they look at the world, the global refugee crisis, they look at all these flows of people, and they think that all of those people just want to come to where we are. They just want to get to the good places of the earth. And it has to be said that that was never the plan. The plan was to get the safety. And for us, for my dad, that was always to get out of our village. And the extent of his plan was to get out of the country. And now, depending on where you are in Afghanistan, you can either go west into Iran or east into Pakistan. And just where we were, it was easier to go east into Pakistan. So we found ourselves at this little refugee camp, this Hazara-dominated refugee camp on the outskirts of Quetta, Pakistan. And that's actually the first time I heard the word refugee, or Rafiji, as you say it in Farsi. We had no idea what that meant, but we fit the definition that we were forcibly displaced, that we couldn't live in the areas that we called home, that we had a genuine fear of returning. And so now we were a statistic, a family of individual people and personalities and names that is now bundled up with the millions of other poor, you know, victims of forces outside their control. And it's at that point, when we're living in this little refugee camp, this informal settlement, whatever you want to call it, that we first hear about a potential other pathway, that there are some families, through whispers, through rumors, through contacts, that say, look, there might be a pathway to get to Australia. Why so far ahead? Why all the way there? Well, simply because we were a number in the UN refugee system. The average wait time from application to potentially getting, and again, that acceptance is never guaranteed, but to potential acceptance runs into the decades. And if you're a mum and dad with five kids, you can't wait 12, 15 odd years before your application might be resettled. So that's why this secondary, this informal, this other pathway comes to the mind. And that's when we started to hear about this pathway to Australia.
With false documents, your family managed to board a plane in Pakistan and fly to Indonesia, the first time any of you had been on an aeroplane. Where did you find to live in Jakarta?
We arrived in Jakarta, and again, being informal, being illegal, having not come through the proper pathways, we were living in secret, living in isolation, living in, you know, dormitories and abandoned warehouses and any kind of informal accommodation that we could find. And so we were in Jakarta for some months. Again, an incredibly different environment, tropical, incredibly hot and humid. And you compare that to the dry, you know, central highlands of Afghanistan that we were from. And so we were staying at some dormitory or some abandoned warehouse on the outskirts of Jakarta.
How do you remember spending your time? As you say, you're a little kid. These adults are making decisions that you're going along with, but you're also a kid living day to day. How do you remember those months?
Looking back on my entire journey from leaving our village and up to that point, and even, you know, the days and weeks to come, the entire saga, which lasted months, by the way, from the time we jumped into the back of that lorry, it just seems like one giant big adventure to me. You put yourself into the mind of a seven-year-old and you can understand your physical surroundings and the faces and the names of people and places you're at. But what you lack is this greater understanding of the context. Why are you being forced to leave your family and your friends and your classmates and your villages and all that you have known behind? Why are you in some foreign country where you can't speak the language, where you constantly have to hide and you don't no longer feel like a child again? You don't understand any of that. You just know that decisions are being made for you. And so when we were in Jakarta, you know, by then there are a number of other families that we formed a little group. I got to know some of the other kids my age, and we're trying to make sense of it, right? We're trying to play football, play soccer in the streets, and just be children. But we always wondered, why the hell are we here?
What did you have that belonged to you at that point, a bus?
You know, I don't think I had anything besides, actually, yes, a backpack. And in Pakistan, my dad had got a world atlas. I remember that. It was a world atlas, and he kind of showed me where Afghanistan was, where Pakistan was, and it just kind of makes sense of the world. And I think we had a couple of T-shirts and a toothbrush, and I think that was my lively belongings and about one backpack.
Then the night came that you and the other families were driven from Jakarta to the coast. Had you ever seen the ocean before?
No, that was... You know, something that perhaps we overlooked when we set on the Australia route was this is a group of landlocked mountaineers about to embark on a crossing of the Indian Ocean, right? You couldn't get more extremes than what we were about to embark on. We had never seen the ocean. I think some people who may have been awake during the flight might have had glimpses of it when they were in the airplane. But when the biggest body of water you have seen is the little creek that runs through your village, and then you are now at the shores of the Indian Ocean, again, describing one of those goosebump feelings, one of those out-of-body experiences, that's exactly what it was like. I think the only thing that took some of the edge off was the fact that it was the middle of the night, it was pitch black, and you couldn't make sense of the scale and enormity of what you're about to embark on.
As the sun rose, what kind of boat did you and the other family see was waiting for you?
You know, we're being bundled into the belly of this ship. You can tell that there's a lot of people because of the van loads of people that have arrived. And the conversation between my mum and dad about whether they get on this boat or not was incredibly, incredibly difficult, because having fled their homeland, having gone to a refugee camp, having then decided to go to jump on this boat or not, I use choice and decision almost as if they're appropriate, but they're entirely inappropriate because the die had been cast for them, right? They didn't have a choice. They had to flee the village. They didn't have a choice because they were never going to get resettled from a refugee camp. And they didn't have a choice now, because if they didn't get on that boat, they were going to be homeless and begging on the streets of Jakarta. And yet, in that very final moment, mum and dad are thinking, do we do this with our kids? Do we get on board? Mum was incredibly hesitant, obviously, maternal instincts. And dad says, look, we've made it this far. And it's the only time in their relationship where dad's ever won an argument. So, we get on that boat. And we knew of the potential dangers of what we were getting into, to the extent that we could understand what the ocean was like. But nobody goes onto that boat willingly being like, I'm ready to risk my children's lives. They go in there because they are attracted by that faint, slim glimmer of hope that we may be able to be resettled in Australia. And so we get up, we get on this boat, middle of the night, and then we start to feel it going, it's moving, and by the time the sun rises, land disappears behind us. And we get a greater sense of what we're on, and that is this old wooden rickety fishing boat. And we can't tell how many people are on board, but this thing is loaded up.
On the second day, the engine gave out. What happened after that?
The engine had been spluttering. It went fine for about 12 or 18 hours or so. And then it started spluttering, and within 24 hours, it was just dead in the water. There are a few folks who I think were mechanics in a former life who tried to revive it, and it stopped and started. But by and large, within a day and a half, it was completely dead. And there was no motion. There was nothing. We were just rollicking in the waves there. Some people started to tear bits of the decking off and, the planks and try to paddle, but it was no use. The ship was too large for manpower. And then the first day, hopes and expectations were incredibly high and people were incredibly optimistic. The second day, when we were dead in the water with no land in sight, it was the exact opposite. We had just gone from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. And that's at that low, at that, rock bottom, that's when fear and doubt and anger started to come to the boil.
On the third night, a storm hit. What do you remember of that?
It is etched so vividly into my memory. It is in high definition, almost as if it happened last night. But trying to convey the sense of fear and just sheer tragedy of the event is just so difficult for people to realize. You might see something like Life of Pi, for example, and think, oh yeah, you understand what it's like to be out in the ocean. We were this little boat in the Indian Ocean with a storm that was just rocking it around like we were some bath toy at the mercy of a child. Again, being incredibly overcrowded, we were being tossed and turned, and we were bodies and luggage and human waste and seawater, and almost like a little blender. Thankfully, being a small child, I was able to grab onto my dad, who had wrapped his belt around one of the rafters, and he had a hook that he could hold onto, and we were safe. But, I remember distinctly seeing with my own eyes holes starting to appear on the side of the boat, luggage and waste, and thankfully no humans, just flooding through that ocean spray from the top, taking water from every angle.
Was it noisy? Were people screaming?
If you look beyond the tragedy of every wave rocking the ship and the screams that would ensue after every time the ship rocked and rolled, beyond that was prayer. It started off with a low hum on an individual level to then growing into this massive cacophony of harmony, of people all shouting at the top of their lungs the same prayer. And it went from a prayer of salvation to please save us, to another one which is focused on mercy, to another one which is essentially your last rites. You know, people went from please, you know, save our souls, to forgive us for our sins, to, you know, I interviewed someone else in writing this, and he says, I was at the point where my literal prayer, word for word, was, oh Lord, if we are to drown tonight, then let our bodies wash ashore so we can be buried on land. Now that is the level of desperation and fear that had gripped people. Because again, here we were, a boatload of asylum seekers from the central highlands of Afghanistan at the mercy of the Indian Ocean. Why? For the very fact that we were unsafe on land, and now, tragically, almost comically, we were now unsafe on the ocean as well.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, head to abc.net.au/conversations.
A bus after this terrifying storm, the sun finally rose and thankfully you were all still alive. What appeared on the horizon? What did you see?
You know, by an act of God, an act of faith, an act of miracle, whatever you want to call it, we survived that night, and we're all kind of gathered up the next morning, ocean's a bit calmer, overcast still. And we're all looking out at the horizon. People are trying to see if they can fix the motor, if they can get some sort of motion going again. And look out at the horizon, and there's a small black dot that is breaking the line between the sky and the sea. Looks like it's headed for us. And it comes closer and closer and closer and closer, and to the point where this giant red metal wall blocks out the entire horizon. And lo and behold, it is the MV Tampa, a 260-meter long behemoth of a container ship that is the pride and joy of the Norwegian shipping line, Wilhelmsen shipping line. You know, we didn't even know if it'd seen us up until the point where it stopped right next to our little fishing boat. It dropped down a ladder, and two sailors in orange jumpsuits came down. And that's when we knew we'd been rescued.
What was it like climbing up that ladder?
You know, there's no English spoken, but we knew what to do. One of the sailors imitated, you know, hand, foot, go up this ladder, don't look down. And I was a little child, and so I couldn't reach the bottom of the rung. So I was kind of lifted out like a rugby line out move. And, you know, that kind of set the motion for me becoming a prop in a later life. And so... I'm never not tall enough for a lock, but I'd make a good prop, which I did later, years later. But I was lifted up in this line out, grabbed the bottom rung of the ladder, and, you know, here we were climbing up these floors. I think it must have been about 12 stories of ladders. From afar, we might have looked like a row of ants climbing up the leg of a giant red elephant. You know, that's what it looked like. Don't look down. Just don't look down. Just hand, foot, look up. And after what seemed like an eternity, we get to the top of the ladder and we're standing on what feels like solid earth. For the first time in almost 3 days, we felt like we were on solid earth. And that's how big the ship was. And there's another sailor there who was marking with a Sharpie, putting numbers on people's wrists to try and figure out how many people were being rescued. And that's at that point that we realized how many were on our little boat. The last number was 438, and that was 433 mostly Hazara Afghan asylum seekers plus five crew members. And just to see that mass of humanity sprawled out in various states of, medical conditions on the deck of the Tampa, that's when we started to see a scale of the enormity of what we had gone through.
What happened to that little fishing boat that you just escaped from?
Oh, man, So we weren't allowed to take anything with us. That saying, literally the clothes on your back, that was us to a T. We weren't allowed to take any luggage. You know, all the little things we might have brought with us to start a new life, whether it was a photo album, whether it was a Quran, whether it was a necklace, jewelry, clothing, whatever. All of that was kept on the palapa. And as the very last person, as the sailor who once had gone and checked that everyone was, off the boat, it had already been taking water as the last people were getting off. But by the time the last person got off and was climbing up the ladder, the palapa, the little fishing boat that we were on, sank. And it disappeared into this little, tiny little hurricane of activity. And it's now resting at the bottom of the Indian Ocean, I guess.
So you were moments, literally moments away from sinking.
Exactly. I mean, that's never lost on me how throughout my journey from leaving our village to, being rescued in the days to come, how close to death we had come, from the journey to the checkpoint, to living in a refugee camp, to living in Jakarta, to being on that boat. We had faced death at multiple instances, but that moment and the night before of the storm, that was when we were within touching distance of saying goodbye.
How did the crew treat you once you were all on board the Tampa?
The Captain Arnie Renan, who had grown up from being a deckhand at the ripe old age of 16 to, spending 40 years at sea to being the commander of this vessel and his crew, particularly First Officer Christian Molto, they were consummate professionals. They realized that they had just performed one of the largest maritime rescues in modern history. And theirs was a container ship made for cargo. And I think at its peak, it has accommodation for about 25 people, right? 25 crew members. And here we were, an extra 400 odd sick and, very much high needs rescuees that they had just picked up. And they were utmost professionals running around using every last drop of whatever they had in their first aid kits. There was no medical doctor on board, but, they knew enough to perform an IV drip to food and aid and all the rest of it that they could. And so they were just incredibly, incredibly hospitable and generous and most importantly, courageous people. And to this day, one of the things that always sticks with me is I don't think any one of us had the language capacity or the moment to thank them for that. And so Captain Renan and Christian Molto and the other crew members, they, my hat's off to them and we are eternally grateful for their service.
There was some back and forth then between the refugees and the captain and Australian officials. And ultimately, mm-hmm. Captain Renan decided that the maritime rules required him to head to the nearest port, which was Christmas Island, about 4 hours away. But once mm-hmm. the Tampa arrived at Christmas Island, the Australian government, led then by John Howard, refused to allow survivors to land. And this standoff was becoming a huge international story. Did you and the other refugees have any idea about this bigger political context that your rescue was happening in? I mean, you wouldn't have as a child, but did your parents, did the adults on board have a sense of this context that was unfolding around them?
No, not at all. We assumed that it would be a pretty straightforward drop-off at Christmas Island and that would be the end of it. But it became apparent that something was awry when Christmas Island was within a few kilometres. We were just on the outskirts of Christmas Island, could see it, we could make out the buildings, but the captain said, we'll hold off here until we get clearance to go in and drop you off. Little did we know that, there were conversations happening at the highest levels of Australian government to make an example of the people that were rescued, that, yes, you may have the right to seek asylum, but not in Australia, even though we're a signatory to it, and definitely not under my circumstances.
Captain Rinnan had requested medical help be brought on board, and two boats were sent over from Christmas Island to the Tampa. But it wasn't doctors. Who boarded the Tampa?
Man, I remember that just as well as I remember the night of the storm, that there's a huge rush of activity, the crew members running around to raise the ladders or something along those lines. But before they could, the Tampa is boarded by dozens and dozens of soldiers, which turned out to be elite Australian SAS troops that had been given the order, obviously again, from their superiors and their commanders in Canberra to seize the ship. And, it meets every definition of piracy, right? That Australia had literally just sent its most highly trained military assets, the most elite soldiers in the military fighting force, to take over and seize a container ship that had just rescued 400 odd asylum seekers. And so begins this incredible standoff between Captain Rinnan, who is the commander of the vessel, and there are certain legal obligations that come with that, and the new commander of the SAS, who has just commandeered the boat, but gives him assurances that, yes, you're still the captain. We're just, the vessel is still in your control. Don't mind me and the 50 guys with long guns that have just come on board.
What were those soldiers, what did they look like to you? You're just 7 years old. What do you remember seeing?
All black. These guys were kitted out in full kit, from the combat boots to the long sleeves, to the helmets, to the goggles, to the gloves. That was it. And there was, dozens, at least 40 or 50 of them surrounding the little, I call it the town square, the little area of deck space that we called home.
Were people scared of those soldiers? What did they think might happen with men with guns suddenly on board?
Yeah, there was a very palpable sense of fear that just coursed through the boat, because here we were, surrounded physically in a perimeter by unidentified men with guns and looking pretty intimidating, as they are supposed to do. It's in their job description. We had no idea what was happening. We had no idea of why they had boarded the boat, who had given the order, what their operations were or objectives were now that they were on board. So it was just palpable fear, because where we're on from, guys with big guns, it only leads to bad outcomes, right? And if you're in the hands of them, you either get killed, disappeared, or given, beaten up severely. So they had no idea what was going on.
The Norwegian ambassador to Australia was finally granted permission to board the Tampa. What happened then?
Again, unbeknownst to us, the Tampa had become an international story. And if you look at media coverage of the events at the time, we were a bunch of faceless and nameless foreigners held offshore in some distant ocean that the Australian public needed to be incredibly worried about. And so lost amidst that was that the Norwegian government got involved, because this was a Norwegian freighter. And I think legally it's a piece of sovereign Norwegian territory, essentially. Had been sent there by Oslo to say, sort it out, see what's happening on there and see what the hell the Australians are doing. And he had been held off Christmas Island, but Canberra relented and allowed him to come on board and talk to his own countrymen, which is his right as an ambassador. And as he comes on board, him and Captain Arne Rinnan, which I think for many of us was the first time we actually saw him, because he'd been up on the captain's bridge the whole time. They came and walked through the crowds of, the little rows of us sitting there cross-legged. And someone who could speak English had written a letter claiming asylum. And they rushed up to him and said, take this, which, by the way, has incredible significance, because you need to have a written asylum claim, which, we're being denied from, right? That's why Canberra was very hesitant to allow anyone on board. And the soldiers had been stripped of receiving anything like that. Someone manages to send and fax a copy over to the mainland. And there we have written asylum claim from us. And I quote the letter word for word in my book.
The New Zealand Prime Minister, Helen Clark, offered asylum to families and children who'd been on board the Tampa. How did people on board react to this news that they were being offered asylum in New Zealand?
Oh, man. That was, you know, every day we'd get little snippets of updates on our why we're being held offshore by one of the SAS commanders. Every day just kind of say that there's a court case happening in Australia, you know, thanks to the guys at Liberty Victoria, that, you know, the government was doing X, Y, and Z. And in one of his daily updates, he says that New Zealand is willing to take on some of you guys. And the first question that pops up, some guy at the back says, who's New Zealand? And that was the reaction. That was literally the reaction that people had because, you know, we had no idea who New Zealand was or what it was. And it was explained to us that it was a country. And I think someone pulled out an atlas and, you know, New Zealand often gets left off of global maps. But this atlas actually had New Zealand right there at the bottom of the world. And it was once people realized that they actually meant getting off this ship when we'd been at sea for over a week by that point, we just said, look, just take us there, please. And thankfully, you know, Prime Minister Helen Clark, who'd been watching the Tampa saga play out, had accepted those of us in family units and single children traveling alone. And there was about 130-odd people. And that was a turning point in my life.
What stands out, Abbas, when you think back to those first weeks in New Zealand?
Oh, man. When I think back to, we were on Nauru for one day, right? Those of us lucky enough to be resettled to New Zealand spent one day on Nauru before a charter flight came, picked us up, and then we flew into the land of the long white cloud, Aotearoa, New Zealand, flying into Auckland and seeing the incredible greenery, the blue ocean, just fresh, just clean air. You know, we were given water at the airport, just everything was on another level. To compare what we had been through in the last weeks, keep in mind, by the time we made it to Auckland, we had spent 35 days at sea, 3 days on the Palapa, a week on the Tampa, so almost 28 days on the HMAS Manora, an Australian Navy frigate. We'd spent 5 weeks at sea, and here we were on solid earth, welcomed and given the most incredible welcome to New Zealand. You know, we had the Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre, which is a six-week orientation program that everyone goes through, welcomed with a formal ceremony, given a little introduction, a Welcome to New Zealand 101 class with interpreters on standby, fed and watered, and I credit my bill to the ample amounts of New Zealand beef and dairy that we were fed. It was just like, I mean, can you imagine going from being on the road or on the oceans 6-odd months since we'd left Sungjoy to then arriving in New Zealand September 28, 2001, just worlds and universes apart. And that was home for me. We knew we were home.
What was your family's first house like in New Zealand?
Oh, man, so we did our little 2-month or 6-week orientation in Mangere in South Auckland. And then, you know, by then we've been stamped and tagged and given all the numbers that you need to live in a modern society. And one of those meant that we were distributed throughout the country. And a small group of us, I think about 12 or 15 odd Tampa families, were resettled to Christchurch, Otatahi Christchurch in the South Island of New Zealand. And we get picked up from Christchurch Airport by groups of volunteers who had seen an ad in the paper by the local Red Cross organisation to say that Christchurch is now home to these odd families. Would you have an hour or two a week to volunteer with them? And so at Christchurch Airport, we were welcomed by, I think, half a dozen volunteers with flowers in hand who drove us from the airport along Memorial Ave and to the suburb of Riccarton, you know, working class suburb of Riccarton, and seeing our house on Valentine Ave with a white picket fence, a classic 1950s, 60s weatherboard New Zealand date house, you know, that is quintessential across New Zealand, you know, 3-bed, 1-bath, just a classic. Oh man, can you imagine just the sheer joy that not only had we known that we were now safe and we were home, but just to walk in through that house, you know, with its bright blue door and see all the furniture and everything that was made for us. And now we've got a group of volunteers around us. As a kid, you know, you don't understand much, but you understand that, you know, the feeling of love and security and community and having some dignity, right? You understand that. You don't realize why you don't have it, but you understand when you do have it. And that's exactly what I felt at that moment.
What business did your dad set up after a few years in New Zealand?
You know, the first car we had was this, like, you know, centuries old chariot from the Roman Empire. So that's how old it was, right? And so this thing lasted us for a while before it started constantly breaking down. And this was in the early 2000s. And when it finally, you know, gave up the ghost, we tried to get rid of it because it was just collecting rust there on the driveway. And we essentially paid someone to come pick it up. And that got Dad, who's, you know, an entrepreneurial kind of guy, thinking about whether there's a market for recycling old cars. And turns out that there was no one in Christchurch who did it. So we set up Le Mans Auto Parts, which is Le Mans named after the area of Afghanistan that our village is in. And essentially we buy old cars, we chop it up and we salvage the parts, and the parts that we don't go to scrap metal recycling. And that was set up in, I think, 07, 08. And Le Mans Auto Parts, we've then since expanded and rebranded as Kiwi Car Removals. You know, we've got a team of coming on 30 or 35 staff members based across four different cities, probably one of the largest secondhand car parts dealers, distributors in the country, all within 12, 13 years of setting up shop. That in itself is a story worth sharing because it allowed us so many things. It allowed us finally to stand on our own feet, to move out of state housing, to be financially free, to have an asset base upon which to build on and for our future children to build on. And I'm so, so proud of the risks that Dad and his business partners took in those early years. Keep in mind, their English isn't great, right? They had to learn how to operate a business in a foreign country with foreign networks and foreign regulations, and do so having been on welfare, and that check isn't all that generous, and to make it happen. And man, it's paid off.
You were soaring ahead at school yourself. What competition did you enter in your first year of high school?
Yeah, I was walking outside the English department, and I saw a poster for the New Zealand National Spelling Bee, sponsored by Vegemite. I said, I've always been good at spelling. And so I enter it and, you know, win the regionals, and then we'll go to the nationals. And yeah, one by one, we all begin dropping by flies, you know. It comes my turn and I trip up on the word silhouetted, which is bloody hard enough to say, let alone spell. I trip up and end up getting third in the New Zealand National Spelling Bee. And, you know, it's a cool story. I got a bit of press coverage from it because, you know, here's this little refugee kid who didn't know English only 5-6 years ago. And now he's, you know, one of New Zealand's best spellers.
How far did news of this great success of yours at spelling spread?
Yeah, I got a little coverage in the local paper here, and obviously that stuff gets shared around. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, one of Dad's old contacts back in Afghanistan called him up and said, we've just seen a bus in the local daily over here. And so the little photo of me with a broken arm, because I was, you know, I wasn't that athletic, I was a chubby little kid, with a broken arm, with my little dictionary and bronze medal around my neck, had made it all the way back to Afghanistan. So it's pretty cool how those two worlds kind of collided that way.
You went on from this great success of being New Zealand's third best speller to study political science and history at university, and then went on to be awarded a very prestigious Fulbright scholarship and study at Georgetown University in the States. What about your siblings? What have they got up to professionally?
Yeah, you know, my siblings have been, you know, successful in their own right. You know, I went down, I guess, the more academic route, but, you know, everyone has their strength. You know, my older brothers are now involved with the family business as directors and shareholders. But prior to that, Ali, who's one older than me, he got an athletic scholarship, a college scholarship to the United States playing soccer. And then, you know, my sister, also older than me, she was the first in our family to enroll and attend and graduate from university. You know, she got a master's in biochem from University of Otago. you know, and my other brother, Sam, he got, you know, he got his pilot's license. And my two younger brothers, who just finished high school, one of them's enrolled in drama. So everyone's just doing their own thing. And it's just, I see that as a reflection of what happens when you give people opportunity to thrive. That in countries as lucky as New Zealand and Australia, that when you give people the ability to thrive, and then you also mix that with good values and good role models around them, there's no stopping you, right? So we were thirsty and hungry for so much of our lives, and now finally we were safe and secure and had the world at our feet. And Dad, who's such a huge, huge influence on all of us, just said, look, man, you can become whatever it is that you want to become. You just got to work hard at it. You could consider yourself a victim, or you could turn your life around. And man, that's worked out in our favor so, so much.
What do you think your dad and your mum see when they look at you kids and grandkids as they have now? Do they take a moment to reflect on how things have worked out?
Yeah, you know, one of the constant themes when you are an immigrant or a refugee background is a question of belonging, of identity that is always there. And for me, having come here as a little kid, it's a little bit easier to grapple with that because, you know, I consider myself a Kiwi with Afghan heritage. You know, I've just been engaged, just got engaged to Jen, my missus, the local Kiwi girl here. Much to the dismay of my parents, who wanted me to find a nice Afghan girl from the villages, but I think Jen's all right. For them, though, when they come here as an adult, they find it incredibly hard to fit, to belong, to have that sense of identity. But for them, the source of pride and happiness comes from seeing us thrive and flourish in the way that we have. I mean, this book, After the Tampa, is dedicated. You know, in the dedication, it says, to Mum and Dad, thank you for giving up your today for our tomorrow.
Abbas, I'm so happy that your story has such a happy ending, and congratulations on your upcoming wedding. I'm sure your parents will be happy once the day arrives.
Cross that bridge when it comes to it.
Thank you so much for telling your story on Conversations.
Thank you so much. And everyone has a story. Mine just happened to be one of forced displacement and refugees. But the underlying theme of my story, and hopefully this conversation, is that adversity or pain or challenges is a gift that everyone receives and nobody wants. So what are you going to do about it? For us, we were refugees. For others, it might be something else. So nobody wants to go through that, but you're going to have to, and that builds character. And that's the kind of takeaway that I want people to get from this conversation. Thank you so much, Sarah, for having me.
Abbas Nazari's book is After the Tampa. And next year, Abbas Nazari will hopefully make it to Australia to talk about his book at a bunch of different writers' festivals. So keep your eye out for that. There's plenty more stories that he has to tell. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.